This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, South Africa has been under Black political rule for a quarter century, but remains the most unequal society in the world. We'll speak with the author of a book on South Africa's Poor People's Movement, and the investigation into alleged collusion between WikiLeaks, the Trump campaign, and the Russian government is going into its third year, but there is still no hard evidence of so-called collusion. So what's behind all the anti-Russia hysteria?
But first, the celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday is both a national holiday and a political institution. But Larry Hamm, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, headquartered in Newark, New Jersey, points out that Dr. King's writings have not been incorporated into the nation's public school curriculums.
Well, the irony of the situation is that this would have been the 90th anniversary of Dr. King's birthday. We had 90 years past his birth. He would have been 90 years old had he lived. And we are, what, about 60 years, almost 60 years past his assassination. And the fact of the matter is that for the masses of Black people, the inequality, discrimination, and racial violence that we faced at the time that Dr. King was assassinated in 68, we're still plagued by that today. In fact, when you look at the actual numbers, when you look at indicators like income, home ownership, job, employment, and unemployment, you see that in many ways, not only are the figures the same, but in some cases, we're actually in worse condition than we were in 1968. One of the exceptions, of course, might be the number of African Americans that have been able to achieve a college education, which absolutely is connected to the civil rights movement and the passage of the civil rights legislation, the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Higher Education Act, et cetera. So there absolutely are more, absolutely and relatively more African Americans that have graduated from college over the last 40 years than there were in the previous 40 years. But when we look at the economic situation, it's almost as dire as it was, if not more so than in 1968. I mean, there are probably, in terms of the numbers, more Black people actually living in poverty today than there were in Dr. King's day. There are twice as many poor people in general, we know that to be a fact, as there were in 1968. And I saw a statistic the other day that said regarding Black and white income that the wealth gap between African Americans and whites, that at the current rate of progress, it would take 280 years more to close that gap. So I don't have 280 years to live. So if we want to see some change in the near future, we better start fighting or keep fighting or intensify the fight that we're engaged in now.
And we should mention there are five or six times as many people in prison, largely Black, as in 1968.
And that is the most glaring statistic, that, say, in about 1966, there were 100,000 Black people in prisons in the United States. Today, there are over 1.2 million. That's a tenfold increase. That's an abomination in a country like this, in one of the richest countries in the world, that we should have so many people living in poverty, so many people in jail, so many people homeless, and on and on and on. So the fact of the matter is that Dr. King's struggle, what he was struggling for, continues. And there's an aspect of that struggle that we must place greater emphasis on. And that aspect is systemic change. Dr. King was a reformer. The Civil Rights Act was a reform. The Voting Rights Act was a reform. The Civil Rights Act of 68, also known as the Fair Housing Act, those were reforms which helped in some respects to ameliorate the condition of Black people. But it didn't fundamentally change our status in this country, and it certainly didn't abolish the paradigm of white superordination and Black subordination. So the aspect of Dr. King's fight that the mainstream focuses on, or corporate America focuses on, is that of civil rights, the struggle for civil rights. But Dr. King was also fighting for systemic change. It was Martin Luther King. In his book, if people read his book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, in the subchapter titled The World House, Dr. King said we need a radical redistribution of power and wealth in our society. That's a quote. And more than that, he said we need a radical transformation of our socioeconomic system. Dr. King was anti-imperialist. He opposed not only the Vietnam War, he opposed most of the imperialist aggressions that the United States was engaged in around the world. He was an anti-imperialist and he was anti-capitalist, increasingly so toward the end of his life. And I think that that was one of the reasons they assassinated. Most people focus on Vietnam, the fact that he came out against the Vietnam War. Yes, I agree with that. That was one of the reasons they assassinated, but that wasn't the only one. I think probably even more threatening than his opposition to the Vietnam War was his increasingly anti-capitalist rhetoric and his demand for systemic change, not just to eliminate racial inequality, but to eliminate a system that not only produces racial inequality, but in fact depends on inequality. So I think that that's really one of the things we need to be focusing on in the 21st century.
People's Organization for Progress demonstrate weekly, sometimes every day. If Dr. King was alive, even at age 90, would he be leading demonstrations and organizing direct actions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Many people don't know that Dr. Martin Luther King in his lifetime was arrested more than 30 times for his participation in actions of what we call direct action and nonviolent civil disobedience. And if he was doing that in 1968, I know he would be doing it in 2018 if he was physically able to at age 90. There's no doubt in my mind that Dr. King would be on the front lines of many of these struggles. He'd be calling for an end to the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan. He'd be calling to the end of U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen and the eight other wars that we're involved in against the war. He'd be calling for drastic cuts to the military budget. Imagine what Dr. King would say of our military budget today, which is probably five or more times the size of the military budget in the year 1968, the fiscal year 1968, when Dr. King was alive. You know, Dr. King said that a nation that spent more on bombs than it did on spiritual uplift was a nation that was doomed. So we're spending so much more money today on warfare and on militarism than we were in 1968. Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, while he was working to organize a local of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. If he was to see how union membership has declined since he was alive, you know, at one point after World War II, about 49% of the American labor force was unionized. Today, less than 11%. of the American workforce is unionized. And for the first time in American history, there are more unionized people in the public sector than there is in the private sector. And, you know, unions are a main line of defense of the standard of living of the working class. We see in the advanced industrial capitalist societies that have a high level of unionization, the working people in the middle class has a higher standard of living. I think one of the reasons we're going backward in this country is because such a small percentage of American workers are unionized. And I definitely think that Dr. King would be speaking out about that. And when Dr. King was alive in 1968, he was calling for universal health care back then in 68. So I'm sure he would be pleased to see that finally it's on the agenda that finally, for the first time, I think, in the history of Congress, they're actually going to hold hearings on Medicare for All, which is an important step toward universal health care in the United States.
Nowadays, everybody and their mama says they're a socialist. Majorities of young people, 18 to 29, say they prefer socialism to capitalism. And these new socialists, I guess, would be happy to learn that Dr. King was also a socialist.
He absolutely was a socialist. I believe in his own words, he said he leaned toward some form of democratic socialism. You know, it's so interesting because this is the part of Dr. King's legacy you never hear about. You might even hear about him speaking out against the war in Vietnam and that he was an anti-imperialist. You might even hear, you know, something about making a criticism that would be anti-capitalist. But you hardly would ever hear anyone mention the fact that Dr. King thought of himself as some type of socialist in the sense that he wanted to see a more equitable distribution of the wealth in society to be returned to the masses of people in society. But this is part of the task of radicals and progressive scholars and activists. We have to unearth that aspect of Dr. King's legacy, and then we have to do everything we can to propagate it. You know, on a practical level, one of the things that I would propose to activists in this country is we have a national King holiday. We have a national King monument. We have roads and schools and most of the cities in the United States named after Dr. King. But I challenge anyone to tell me what school district in the United States of America actually requires any of the books that Dr. King wrote to be on their required reading list. Not the what do they call the supplemental or recommended reading list, but the actual required reading list. Like when we were in school, we were required to read Tale of Two Cities by Dickens and other books like that. If we're going to have a King holiday, then King's writings and speeches should be a part of the curriculum and students should be exposed to it. I didn't learn anything about Martin Luther King when I was in school. What I learned about Dr. Martin Luther King, I learned outside of the classroom and I learned after I graduated high school. Remember, many of us were still in high school when Dr. King was assassinated, so we didn't even have the national holiday. But, you know, if the national holiday is just going to be another sale day, then I say to hell with it. You know, don't have a holiday if that's what we're going to use it for. Let's use a holiday to try to help propagate the ideas, philosophies that Martin Luther King stood for.
Could it be that the powers that be don't want to propagate Dr. King's actual works in which he talks about ideas that are antithetical to the current world order?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And they have, you know, an army of paid academicians and public relations people and so forth to make sure that we get a neutered King legacy. They want to make As one philosopher said, they want to make King a harmless icon. But we got to do some judo. We got to use the fact that this society was forced. Remember, the King holiday was something that we had to fight for. And up until the last minute, the President of the United States resisted signing the legislation that had been passed to create the King holiday. King holiday didn't come out of the government. It came out of the people's movement. You know, it came out of the remnant of the civil rights movement and the efforts of a lot of young people and the next generation of activists to make that holiday a reality. So they took it and they neutered it and they tried to recycle it and give it back to us in a form that will not be harmful to the social order that benefits them. But we have to do some judo and use that holiday that was made into law by the government, accepted, that has been accepted as a holiday by society, and use that to, in fact, bring forward the revolutionary ideals for which Dr. King stood. As far as I'm concerned, Dr. King was a revolutionary. He wanted to see the revolutionary transformation. He might not have been the particular brand or style of revolutionary that many of us envision, but he was one who wanted to see a change in the social order. He fought for reform. He fought for those things that would improve the lives of the masses of the people. But he saw that the very oppressive conditions from which the people were seeking relief could not be remedied unless there was a change in the social order. That is a change in the capitalist system. And it's just amazing to see that we've come to a point where we could even openly discuss that now. I mean, I can remember a time, and I'm sure you can also, Glenn, that we could only talk about socialism in certain circles, at certain times, and with certain people. You know, we had to be a little circumspect as to who we would raise this discussion with. But now we see a discussion going on in the public square about capitalism. And as you pointed out, the youth of today, a large segment of them are anti-capitalist or at a minimum critical of the capitalist system. And why are they critical? Because they're being affected negatively by the capitalist system. These young people are graduating college with bank debt. They had to go to banks and get loans from which banks profit in order to complete their college education. And just for undergraduate school, for 4 years of undergraduate school, students are graduated with 30, 50, even I've even heard of cases of $100,000 of debt just for an undergraduate education. That's criminal. We should have free college education in the United States of America. The student debt that exists, it should be forgiven because these students will never really prosper from their college degrees as long as they have this suffocating debt they have to pay off. That debt should be forgiven, and we should have free college education in the United States of America. He advocated, I know it was part of his economic bill of rights, a quality education, but I'm sure Dr. King would support that demand, that debt forgiveness for our young people and free college tuition for those who are in college and those who are aspiring to go to college. Because it doesn't make sense. I mean, if you graduate from college and you get a job, your first job is maybe $35,000, $40,000 a year, you're actually bringing home, after all your deductions, maybe $2,000 or maybe even less than $2,000 a month. If you have to pay off the bank $1,000 a month, you're basically at the minimum wage. You know, the whole reason to go to college has been defeated.
In France, young adults' rents are subsidized because the philosophy of the state is that young people should not be burdened early in life with onerous bills and debts. But in the United States, they are burdened immediately with these college tuition fees.
That's right. And now you see a critical difference. That's a great example. A critical difference between, and now France is a capitalist country. It's not a socialist country. It's a capitalist country. But the United States is a capitalist. They're both capitalist countries. But what is one of the big differences? One of the big differences is they have a much stronger trade union movement in France. They have a stronger left movement in France. Not only left movement, they have leftist political parties that have been institutionalized and can, in fact, facilitate transmission of these ideas generationally. And so it results in a whole different set of economic policies. And just think, even with that you just spoke about, the subsidized rent, the yellow jackets in France, they're raising hell. Because the Macron government, with its neoliberal policies, has in fact been trying to erode all those gains that the working peoples of France made over the years. So they're fighting to preserve those reforms that we envy. We're envious of this because we're in a hyper-capitalist state. Our working people here don't have half the benefits that working people in France, in Germany, in England. Look, England is a capitalist country, but they have a national healthcare system. And one of the big fights that's going on right now has been the budget austerity and the budget cuts to the national healthcare system in England. And people are struggling around that. So the United States might be the wealthiest capitalist country in the world, but it is the most backward in terms of its social policies. And this is why we have to build a radical movement. We have to continue to build, because there is a radical movement in this country, but it's small. And we must build it up and make it stronger and make it bigger so that we can fight for those reforms that will ameliorate conditions in people's lives, the working people, poor people, the middle class, and also continue the struggle for systemic change. Because as long as we have this kind of system, we're going to have this problem of racial inequality, racial discrimination, racial violence. And we see the Klan and we see the neo-Nazis, and now they're not just marching the streets, but they're operating in highest levels of government. They've joined law enforcement. The FBI came out with a report just a couple of years ago that said that right-wing racist groups had infiltrated all levels of law enforcement, including the FBI itself. Like, we didn't know that.
That was Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress, speaking from Newark, New Jersey.
South Africa remains the world's most unequal nation, despite the overthrow of white rule and racial apartheid 25 years ago. Kerry Chance is an anthropologist at the University of Bergen in Norway. She's author of a new book on the millions of poor South Africans that struggle to find homes to raise their families. Dr. Chance's book is titled Living Politics in South Africa's Urban Shackland.
Since the election of Nelson Mandela in 1994, the ANC has really tried to redress inequalities inherited from a colonial past, while at the same time demobilizing the quote-unquote ungovernable protests that characterized the late liberation struggle of the mid-1980s. So the party has done things like cultivate participation in formal democratic institutions, including voting. It's expanded basic infrastructure provision. A host of new redistributive grants have been created. And a new South African constitution has been written, which has been hailed as one of the most progressive in the world. And yet, South Africa remains one of the world's most unequal societies more than 20 years after the fall of apartheid. So the unemployment rate is minimally estimated at 25%. In the places I worked, it was more like 65% or 75%. Millions are living without formalized housing, and there's a yawning gap between rich and poor. So, I mean, South Africa's shack-dwelling population roughly is estimated that it's the same population as America's largest cities, so 5.2 million, or Chicago and Boston combined. And moreover, you know, these townships and shack settlements, while they're sort of commemorated as sort of battlegrounds of liberation struggle, they're also seen newly as slums, so they're earmarked for clearance or economic development. So people have quite often been forcibly removed again en masse from visible public spaces in the city, so have been dispossessed of land and informal markets and the streets. Increasingly, we've also seen the settlements that I've been working in an intensification of police violence and assassination. So six activists have been killed in Durban since last year. So what my book is trying to do is sort of analyze the criminalization in recent decades of popular forms of politics that were foundational to South Africa's celebrated democratic transition. And part of what I argue is that as the lines become between the criminal and the political become blurred in public discourse and through these interactions that I mentioned, shack settlements and the state have yet again been set against each other. The state, however, is inhabited by a party of incomplete liberation and composed of diversifying governing institutions. So the book is really trying to show how political spaces are redefined, state sovereignty is forcibly enacted, and these new forms of citizenship and identity begin to congeal at the intersections of gender, race, and poverty. So continuities and discontinuities throughout.
You speak of the criminalization of popular forms of politics, and that sounds like the criminalization of the poor, a phenomenon we're familiar with in the United States as well.
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of linkages, and I think, you know, it's not surprising then that we see in movements like Abashali Basanjimbolo, the South African shack dwellers movement, and other movements that I've worked with in South Africa, many international linkages, particularly in the U.S., to those who are addressing issues of housing, of environmental racism, of economic inequality. So we see these kind of grassroots linkages being constructed, and yet again, of course, from previous generations, but through new technologies and ways of organizing on the streets.
Dislocated workers from elsewhere in Southern Africa have flowed into South Africa. How have they been received, and what role do they play in the slum dwellers' movements?
Yeah, what we've seen in the post-apartheid period is the resurgence of a kind of xenophobic ethno-nationalism. And there's no question that we, you know, see the rise of this of ethno-nationalist majoritarian populism sort of all over the globe, from South Africa to Brazil to India to the United States. So the residents in South Africa often say the anger of the poor can go in many directions, and it certainly can go in and has gone in the direction in some instances of non-ethnic political mobilization or in the direction of xenophobic pogroms. So some of the movements that I've worked with, Abashali, for instance, have tried to kind of push against this rising tide of xenophobia and incorporate into political mobilization anyone who happens to find themselves in shack settlements, regardless of where they happen to have been born. The way that I track this in the book is how it is that the poor collectively self-identify, but also how that identification, that collective mobilization as the poor, breaks apart in certain pogroms. And the one that I track specifically over a 24-hour period is actually unfolding through an ethnically motivated xenophobic pogrom that left three men dead and over 1,000 people displaced in the shack settlement of Kennedy Road. And I was there at the time. What I found in this pogrom and others that I witnessed or studied is that what is central here is ethnic modularity. By modularity, I mean a kind of multi-ethnic group of people often mobilize under the banner of ethnic Zuluness, using Zulu songs or slogans and shouting that they were routing out non-Zulus. Most of the attackers, however, were not themselves Zulu, but ordinarily self-identified as Amabaka or Xhosa or Pedi or from ethnically mixed families and so on. However, the attacks were sort of mobilized under this rubric of Zulu nationalism that resonated with an ethnicization of the ANC under Jacob Zuma. So this is not a kind of ethnic hybridity that assumes fluidity of identity, but it's a kind of hardening and fixing of identity that we see in various places. So it's a kind of negative flip side of what Gayatri Spivak has called strategic essentialism, by which she means people of different backgrounds coming together against globalization or unemployment or other common goals. This kind of essentialism is ethnically based and quite conservative. And we can see this kind of sentiment rising in the U.S. certainly as well.
Coming together possibly objectively against globalism, but specifically against other Black folks.
Absolutely.
Well, you're speaking of this movement of the poor, of slum dwellers, as something apart, apparently, from the electoral struggles that are going on in South Africa. We have not only, of course, the ruling party, the ANC, but it's challenged on the left by the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, and more recently by a Socialist Workers Revolutionary Party that's just been launched by NUMSA, the country's biggest trade union.
Yes, I think it's important to be tracking South African electoral politics at this time because there's been many recent transformations. I mean, I think where you can especially see these dynamics clearly are debates around land. So it's been reported in the international news, South Africa is undergoing a process of land reform, and land reform announced by the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has sought to kind of capture some populist sentiments that you know, land should be redistributed. So it's borrowing in some sense from what's already been said by popular social movements, but also by the EFF. But this announcement by Cyril Ramaphosa has led to panic condemnations across the globe, including by Trump and the United States, and who used it as kind of race-baiting talking point. I mean, land, of course, remains radically unevenly distributed across racial lines. And I mean, statistics are problematic, but I mean, following the 1913 Land Act, only an estimated 13% of the soil was in African hands. So central to this debate between parties is about land reform, is about eliminating the principle of willing buyer, willing seller. And this means those involved in the transaction sort of enter into a voluntary contract, of course. And this has been championed by the World Bank after apartheid. And activists have decried this, and parties have as well, as willing buyer, this willing buyer, willing seller as neoliberal, market-led, anti-poor, and so on. I think where the kind of disconnect happens over land in terms of what's happening in debates in parliament versus what is happening on the ground in shack settlements, and that movements are articulating and increasingly parties are trying to listen to, is that while land reform is being talked about from above, there's been an intensification of violence and dispossession from below. So residents of shack settlements are increasingly being not only pushed off land that they're occupying, but subject to assassinations and threats of violence and actual police violence. So there's kind of profound disconnect going on between what's happening in parliament and what's happening on the ground. And yet, I think these land reform debates show some kind of reflection of what people have been talking about for a very long time in shack settlements.
Yes, even if hypothetically land was opened up in the countryside through confiscation of white holdings, that wouldn't alleviate the problem of the urban slum dwellers. And those properties in potentially valuable urban areas, that's not under discussion for opening up.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think what's really overlooked in including the intensification of violence around land backed by police on the ground is also that South Africa's post-apartheid land reforms have tended to kind of segregate rural land in Zulu. We might think about Mashaba from urban housing in Zulu, isiZulu. And activists in Abashale and other residents of shack settlements have tried to push against this strong distinction between rural land and urban housing and try to talk more about Ikaya, right, a place to call home, which is a slogan that's used by the anti-eviction campaign and other movements that implies both land and housing. But moreover, I mean, what we've seen is that in urban policy reforms, there's been an effort to re-ruralize the poor. So after apartheid, hundreds of thousands of people began moving to the cities with the lifting of pass laws. And this effort to re-ruralize people has manifested in, for instance, transit camps, which are the latest technology of so-called slum elimination, where tens of thousands of people have been, in some cases, forcibly removed to peri-urban or undesirable spaces outside of the city and kept in what are essentially refugee camps for the urban poor. So typically government-built shacks made of corrugated tin, some electrified, some not, some have running water, but few have regular access to water. So this kind of division between rural land and urban housing, and then moreover, this effort to kind of re-ruralize the poor is extremely problematic. And at the same time, compounding this, the ANC has already sort of announced a kind of end to this infrastructural moment we saw after the end of apartheid, where you have, you know, 2.1 million homes being built. The housing program will soon be suspended. So there's a sense that the crisis is only going to intensify. So you're exactly right that the problem doesn't address giving up desirable spaces in the city.
Decades ago, I read a book called Captive Cape Town, and it chronicled the imposition of grand apartheid in the city of Cape Town in 1948 after the Nationalist Party came to power. And it showed how the black and colored populations of Cape Town were swept out of the central city. And now we see something very much like that that you just described happening again, only under the ANC government.
Yes, in Cape Town, well, it's also under the DA, the kind of which has historically been the kind of white progressive party that's gained power in the Western Cape. So between the DA and the ANC, there in Cape Town, there have been many, well, tens of thousands of people have been relocated, for instance, to the largest transit camp in Delft, which is outside of Cape Town. And we can also see how these dynamics of race and class-based exclusion are reproduced even most recently in Cape Town's Day Zero water crisis, where globally this was framed as, you know, a moment where there would be a major shift in kind of water supplies. But as we know, in shack settlements and in these transit camps, a lack of water supply is a kind of daily experience of the poor. And that's something that international reporting certainly didn't attend to.
Some dwellers describe the ANC political apparatus as acting like a kind of mafia resorting to assassination to break up their organizations.
Yes, we've seen many reports, and I've written about this as well, a kind of rise of a certain hitman politics in South Africa. I think Abashali in KwaZulu-Natal and in Durban have experienced this quite profoundly in trying to mobilize on the streets and in the media and in the courts, the experience of repression that has followed. So there's been many instances, as I mentioned, where activists have been assassinated, and also those who have been forced into hiding in safe houses. So the Saleh founding president had recently, after credible threats of violence, gone into hiding just this past year to mitigate against death threats that he was receiving. So indeed, there has been a real intensification of violence.
Well, the bodies of organizers keep on piling up. What's the next step for the slum dwellers in terms of a political breakthrough?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the shack dwellers speak for themselves and do represent themselves. But what I've noticed that the kind of way forward that ordinary residents have been talking about amongst themselves is, I think, first of all, that one strategy is not enough. So they combine strategies, for instance, as I mentioned, using the streets, the courts, the media, you know, using the streets to take hold of spaces, using digital media to change representations, actively going to court to transform policy. I think also it's about analyzing the fact that things can deteriorate rapidly. So with the assassinations of land activists that are on the rise, there's an acknowledgement that if you hold a parcel of land, you might lose it the next day and regain it again. So the idea that struggle is a constant, historical change is real. So doing away with kind of hindering progress narratives of old. And I think also there's been an emphasis on not letting NGOs, politicians, experts, elites determine their struggle. So again, Abba Saleh represents itself, speaks for itself, makes its own decisions at the grassroots level. So I think a way forward is to see change as not happening from the halls of power as much as at the level of ordinary people. And then at the same time, I think a way forward is cultivating meaningful alliances with grassroots activists locally, regionally, globally, as well as technical teams that can facilitate your objectives, GIS experts, scientists, lawyers, and so on. All Abba Saleh have called upon at various moments in domains where specified knowledge can be powerful. But again, not letting these alliances determine your struggle. So I think that there's been a recalibration of how it is that activists are thinking about interacting with state agents and also interacting with various institutions.
South Africa remains probably the world's most unequal country. To what extent do the South African political classes take responsibility for making such little progress in righting that historical wrong?
Yeah, it is a good question. I mean, I think that, as I said, the ANC, for instance, has certainly attempted to redress inequalities at certain moments. But in many instances, these efforts to redress inequalities have fallen short. So in trying to cultivate democratic participation, it's also sought to squash protests and political mobilization. In an effort to extend housing programs, it's also resulted in land dispossession and, in some cases, people losing their homes. So, I mean, I think that the turning of power in South Africa under the ANC as the ruling party for so long, I mean, so much happened internally to the party. And now what we're seeing is growing strength in the EFF and NUMSA, who are providing a challenge to the ANC and calling for certain responsibility to be taken for instance, the failure of land reform. So we're seeing a shifting of discourses around responsibility, I think.
That was Professor Kerry Chance speaking from Norway.
since before the votes were counted in November 2016, the Democrats and elements of the national security state have charged that Hillary Clinton lost the election because of collusion between the Russians, WikiLeaks, and the Trump campaign. But more than 2 years later, there is still no hard evidence of collusion. We spoke with Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst and one of the founders of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
There's no evidence, but these days, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, they don't need any evidence. They have these pundits that are pushing a story. When you talk about the Russians and WikiLeaks, what's important to remember is that even though people like James Clapper, a perjurer, he lied under oath before Congress, and he was allowed to stay by Obama for 3.5 more years as head of all intelligence. How about that? Despite the fact that he, Clapper, and the gang of three, the heads of the FBI, CIA, and NSA, briefed Obama up and down, like for hours, on the 5th of January, 2017. Now, less than 2 weeks later, Obama felt it necessary to get up before his last press conference, 2 days before leaving town, and saying, and this is a quote, "The conclusions of the intelligence community with respect to how WikiLeaks got, quote, Russian hacking, end quote, are inconclusive." Wow. So we end up with inconclusive conclusions. Now, this was none other than the President of the United States, who had been briefed up and down just 13 days before about conclusive conclusions. Now, I had a rare opportunity, to question Mr. Clapper, now a civilian, of course, as he was pushing his memoir at the Carnegie Endowment here in Washington. So I asked him, how does he explain this? I mean, hello, you gave him a memorandum, which you called an assessment, which really means a guess, okay? And you told him that it was conclusive, that we know how the, quote, Russian hacking, end quote, got to WikiLeaks. So how do you explain the fact that the president doesn't believe you? And he said, I can't explain what the president said. No, I don't know why he said that. So you don't have to really go much further than that, but we have. So we have a group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and we're, well, virtually all retired now. We have a couple of people that tell us things from inside. But what I'm saying here is that we have in our midst two former technical directors of the National Security Agency, NSA. Now, why do I mention that? Well, because they've got expertise in the technical side that won't quit. And so they've done forensics. And they found out that it's a crock, that there is no evidence at all, forensic evidence, no hard evidence of the kind that they work with, that WikiLeaks got anything from a hack of the DNC. One has to be aware, do the Russians hack? Of course, the Russians hack, you know. Was the Russian Military Intelligence Service, the GRU, trying to hack into the DNC? Well, if they weren't, you know, they should be all fired. The question is how WikiLeaks got the DNC emails, which were, of course, pristine pure, but unfortunately for Hillary Clinton, indicated that she had stolen the nomination from Bernie Sanders. That's very embarrassing. So did that have an effect on the election? I imagine it may have, okay. But should WikiLeaks be blamed for that? Well, not unless you can prove that someone gave them to WikiLeaks, like the Russians, from a hack. And we know what a hack is. But these two technical directors have briefed me up and down and saying it was not a hack. It was a leak. It was a leak. How do you do that? Well, you put a little thumb drive. Put a little thumb drive in the DNC computer. Does that mean direct access? Yes, it does. Were there disgruntled people in the DNC when they saw what Hillary did to Sanders? Yes, there were. All right? So it's a kind of no-brainer. And there are two people who know especially exactly how it happened. One is Julian Assange, and the other one is Ambassador Craig Murray. And guess what? Neither Bob Mueller nor anyone else has seen fit to go interview them. So what does that tell you? That tells you that this is a crock, as we used to say in the Bronx. You know, here's a little thing that most people don't know. They hate Julian Assange from another picture, you know, from another film, like Gene Autry. Those Iroquois Indians, they hated him from another picture, right? Well, they hate him not only for the documents on Afghanistan and Iraq and the diplomatic documents, but they hate him because he has this uncanny ability, I imagine it's his friends now, to receive leaks. And the most damaging leak of all was received from a CIA contractor or staffer, it's not clear to me which, but it was released on March 7th, 2017 by Julian Assange, and it was called Vault 7. And what did it include? Well, it included a whole array of offensive cyber warfare tools. Now, we're not talking about defense, we're talking about offense, okay? What did they allow the perpetrators, that would be the CIA new directorate on cyber warfare, 5 years old now, what did it allow them to do? Well, allow them to draw on the expertise of NSA and others who had worked for 15 years to develop these tools. Now, when I asked Bill Binney, who is one of our technical directors, former of the NSA, I said, what does that mean? This business about cyber tools. And he said, Ray, I was around when this started. I hadn't retired yet. And what they were doing was working assiduously to develop these things. And what you need to know, Ray, is that this Vault 7 deal involves 700 million lines of code. Gosh, that sounds like a lot. Let me put it this way, he said. Each line of code costs $25. We're talking about billions of dollars that NSA and CIA sunk into this. Okay, what do they allow CIA to do? Well, on March 7th, we found out that one of these tools allows the CIA or anyone who has the tool to take over the speed of an automobile and make it go 110 miles an hour. Brakes don't work. And you get people killed that way.
Cool. So this is an assassination tool.
Well, that particular one was. The next tool was simply a surveillance tool. You have your TV on, and you turn it off to go to bed or to whatever you do in bed, and guess what? Oh, it's still on. And so recorded is everything that happens in the bedroom after you think you turned it off. Now, that was March 7th. Well, when Julian Assange announced the existence of these cyber tools that had been leaked to him, he said that they've just released a little bit of them. In toto, they amount to intelligence worth more and more voluminous than all the documentation that Edward Snowden brought out into Hong Kong. Wow. So, what does he do on the 31st of March, 2017? Well, he releases a tool called Marble. Marble Framework is what they call it. And what does that allow an entity to do, the CIA in this case? Well, it allows them to hack into a computer or a server, disguise who hacked in, and leave the kinds of signs that might blame it on someone other than who hacked in. The little breadcrumbs. Now, what happened was, it was revealed that they worked in five languages: China, Korea, Arabic, Farsi, and Russian, Cyrillic. So, what was this designed to do? Well, the documents themselves that Assange released indicated they were designed to obfuscate. Who did it? Who hacked in, and leave little telltale signs. Now, there was also a, get this, a quote, the obfuscator, end quote, built in so the CIA could always retrieve what they did. Now, what am I getting at? Well, if you're looking at who actually hacked into the DNC computer system and left little breadcrumbs like, the name of the first head of the KGB, or little signs that a Russian format was used. Well, you know, it's Bill Binney and my guess, and Bill is the NSA technical director former, and it's just as likely that it was John Brennan and the CIA tools that did that, and that Lucifer 2.0, the fellow that's often quoted, the fellow that Bob Mueller based those indictments on, Lucifer 2.0 is a proven fraud. And we can prove that from forensics. Bill Binney could explain it to you far better than I. But once you're demonstrated to be a fraud, well, you shouldn't base indictments on it, and you shouldn't believe anything he says, especially when he tries to connect the DNC emails with WikiLeaks.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.